You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
War, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek The Next Generation. Tonight's episode is Peak Performance. I'm Ben from Arizona.
I'm Sarah from Arizona.
I'm James from London.
And I'm Lou from Nebraska. Did I hear Sarah from Arizona?
Yes.
Oh, somebody's hijacking our call, right?
You can call me Mrs. Proton.
Mrs. Proton! or Mrs. Protonix.
There you go.
All right. Well, Ben and Sarah. Sarah, have you ever been on the Delta Quadrant?
No.
Have you ever heard of it?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Unfortunately. Years of hearing about it.
I find it interesting that you come on our show before you came on Ben's. Or are you planning to?
No.
No? Do you like Voyager?
I do.
I do too. So, the Delta Quadrant. The last one done was Q2.
Yeah.
What are the plans? What are you going to do in after 6 episodes?
Go away. What do they do? They warp off into the sunset, right?
That's
what
pretty much.
Does. That's what all good Star Trek does. Warps off into the sunset.
So are you planning to retire from podcasting, or is there any chances of going on to something else?
I will say, Lou, you know, there's two things. One, we did, in general, I think that the Delta Quadrant was commissioned for the 7th season of Voyager. And that was its primary goal. So once that's accomplished, the, I don't know, how would you say it? Does anything else belong in the Delta Quadrant? I mean,
no.
Not really, but I will say we had a chance. We offered the listeners a chance to give us the same amount of 5-star iTunes episode reviews as there are episodes of Voyager, 170 something, whatever. And we would have done a season 8, but I don't think it's going to happen.
Mm.
I don't know. That's very fortunate.
Yeah, because I was thinking that's what the audience should do is make up episodes for season 8 and then you review them.
Well, we never got any scripts, you know?
Yeah, that requires people to do something.
I know, it requires effort and passion.
Yeah, it's very difficult. No offense, guys, but it's very difficult. And we have already thought about whether we want to go into DS9, and if we do, I even have the name already picked out. So that's going to be a secret for the next 3 years. Okay. Well then, beyond the Delta Quadrant, what else are you into? What do you do?
I would be a Ferengi businessman for work. That's generally what I do.
Sales, huh?
I just know the rules of acquisition. Isn't all business sales?
Mm-hmm.
Everything's salesmanship. It's all sales.
Mm-hmm.
So I do that. Do that every night, all night long. Mm. It's a wonderful existence. I get to see the sunset and the sunrise.
Mm.
Yeah.
And remember, a contract is a contract is a contract, but...
only amongst Ferengi.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, then. Well, let's go. Why don't we go ahead and head on into the synopsis, then?
All right. The synopsis for tonight's show is an attempt to see if Ben catches this, Lou screws up the synopsis. Okay, the real synopsis is...
I got you. I don't know. I didn't get it. You read that ahead. What's a real one?
I always pre-read everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
The real synopsis is, with the Borg threat in mind, Starfleet stages a war game simulation, pitting Captain Picard and the Enterprise against Commander Riker and the 80-year-old Starship Hathaway. However, when the Ferengi suddenly attack, the Enterprise is crippled, forcing Picard into a seemingly no-win situation. This is the 21st episode of Season 2 of Star Trek The Next Generation. Original release date, July 10th, 1989. It was written by David Kemper and directed by Robert Shearer. Guest stars include special appearance by Diana Mulder as Dr. Pulaski, Roy Brocksmith as Sierna Kolrami, Armin Shimerman as Brockthor, David L. Lander as the Ferengi tactical officer, Leslie Neal as Ensign Nagel, Glenn Morshauer as Ensign Burke. So, what do we think about the episode? Well, I think this episode is education in reverse psychology, so I hate this episode. What about you, Sarah?
Well, I didn't think it was a very lively episode in my taste, and I didn't think that when the action came in that was very lively either, so it didn't make up for it in my mind, but I did like other aspects of it.
Doctor?
I quite like this episode. Following those two, I feel bad. But I thought this was perfectly fine. I think it's a good closure to season two. I think it's been a solid season, and I didn't have too many problems with it, to be honest. Lou?
Oh, we get to close season two with this one? That'd be great. Thank you, Doctor. Well, obviously, we found one that Ben's not going to say is a 5. Which is unusual because everything of TNG was supposed to be a 5, and I'm with the Doctor. I like it. There's a couple parts that I have a problem with, but beyond that, the concept is excellent. War Games. I love the movie War Games too. So, yeah, I'm with Doctor. I like it. Okay. All right. So, Doc, what should we do next?
Do you want me to say that we should head into the forum feedback section?
You always do. You want to do the forum feedback now or later?
Let's do it now. Get it out of the way.
If we have Ben on the line, Ben can comment on some feedback he left for Samaritan Snare.
Oh, yeah. Here, Ben. I'm going to put in the group chat a link that I would like you to go to.
Oh, okay.
And it was for Pen Pals, actually.
Oh, so before we do Samaritan Snare, we're going to require Ben to explain himself.
Yeah, you gotta. Wait, let's talk about pen pals, because I was the one reading your forum feedback. I got about halfway through and my eyes started to bleed. I'm like, what the hell is he getting at here?
Wait a second, what are you talking about?
Oh, I couldn't get it. It was jumbling me. So let's talk about your. It was about the morals and the
messages and the meanings.
Yes,
of pen pals. That's the one where Data falls in love with the six-fingered lady, right?
No.
Yep, that's correct. Yeah.
Falls in love with a six-fingered lady?
He's talking about Sargenta and the weird woman with the long fingers.
Sargenta is a pizza. Sarzenka is the girl. Episode.
So wait a second. Did you already read this diatribe I went on here?
Actually, yeah. I did. Started to read it.
Ben read it.
Well,
we got 2/5 of the way through, and then Lou gave up.
I'm like, I stopped, I left it in the show because I thought it was funny. I was gonna edit it out, but I'm like, what the hell is he getting into here? What does he mean? And so, you know, what's up?
Well, I think that Pen Pals really is that episode that clearly defines the arguments about the Prime Directive, right? Mm-hmm. Like, amongst the fans, at least. Because they say it very clearly, what the Prime Directive is, and then they go and do something different. But, So, first things first, you have to understand that, like, I always think about life as you get choices, right? And each situation dictates two choices to you. The right choice and the wrong choice. Mm-hmm. So, that being said, a lot of times we confuse morals and ethics. So we go, killing is either wrong or it's right. Those are the two choices we get when we get to decide if we're going to kill somebody, right? Is that wrong or is it right? But that's a moral choice. Ethics, on the other hand, ethics is all about like rules and regulations. So the Prime Directive would be an ethical code versus a moral code. Do you understand the difference between those two? It's a set of laws, not a set of morals.
Okay.
The Prime Directive is. So when people talk about, like, there's gray area, well, of course there's gray area in the law. There's always gray area in the law. That's why laws are so specifically written to try to eliminate as much gray area as possible. But there is no gray area when it comes to morals. You're either doing the right thing or you're doing the wrong thing.
And then we create gray.
We create gray. Yes, we do.
If it's something that we go, well, I did this, I know it's wrong, but here's why I did it. So you start to create a gray.
That's true. You start to rationalize.
Yeah.
And that's what ethics are for. How far can we rationalize? How much can we rationalize? What's acceptable? But that's totally different than morals.
Okay.
And that's probably what I was talking about mostly.
So as I'm reading over this, kind of like going through it real quick, I'm not really sure if I've read yet where you stand on pen pals, though.
What, on their decision?
Yeah, what do you think of what they did?
Well, first you have to understand that the idea of the Prime Directive as a non-interference law is kind of a ridiculous law, because as James Well knows, one of the core concepts in science is you must, whatever you observe, you affect. You cannot observe without affecting things. So you're constantly interfering if you're out there. So, I mean, just by flying by, they interfered in the natural progression of everything. Just by learning and gaining knowledge, they do so. So the idea that you can't interfere, first things first, puts me off to the Prime Directive just across the board as,
yeah,
you know, a set of ethics that doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. But that's not what they're doing in the episode, by the way. They're trying to tell you that the Prime Directive is a moral way of being. Like that is what has allowed Starfleet to become these morally morally sound people. That they're living their life by this code, and this code is perfect, and if they follow it perfectly, they will too be perfect. But it's a law made by man, it's a set of codes made by man that can't be perfect. So what happens when you run into a situation that pulls at your heartstrings, a little tiny chick going, "Oh, please save me, Data." I mean, what do? You do the emotional thing. Why? Because your emotions generally like to follow your morals.
So you believe they were correct?
To save lives?
Yeah, to save the planet.
Well, sure, why not? I mean, really, what's the big deal? You know?
Well, even if, like, later Picard says, you know, what if one of those lives down there is a child who becomes the next Adolf Hitler or Kahn Singh?
And contrast that by what if one of the children down there becomes the next Einstein, you know, or next Zefram Cochrane in this universe.
Right.
You can play the what if game forever.
Sure.
But at some point, you choose yes or no.
Make a decision.
Yeah, you got to make a choice at some point. If you make no choice, then you're choosing.
You're still choosing.
You're still choosing.
Yeah.
Actually, that's something that we've spoken about this before on the show, and I do kind of agree with where you're going, Ben. I don't think there is a big difference, or at least some people think there's a big difference between, you know, something happening through action rather than something happening through inaction. So the idea that through doing some action, you're going to potentially save the next Hitler, you know, why wouldn't you suggest that through inaction, you're going to save the next
Hitler?
Well,
let me ask you this.
It's a bit redundant. Go ahead.
Well, I would ask you about this then, about inaction versus action. What people say, people can say whatever they want, but you're in action. You're still making a choice. So we're Absolutely. Not animals. We don't run by instinct. We're rational beings that can think not just about what's happened to us in the past, what's happening to us currently, but also look forward into the future and figure things out ahead of time. So whether you truly understand or not, So let's say somebody is walking. I mean, this is a pretty typical thing. Somebody's walking around the mall with a gun, and they are going and trying to shoot people, right? And they're trying to take lives. Well, you're a pacifist, and you say that violence under any circumstances is unacceptable. So your inaction, you took action to make that choice. You took actions to become a pacifist. You know, you thought about it. You've done things. You're not just acting on instinct. So you've made the choice to not act. So the idea that action versus inaction, people are only ever talking about it in a response fashion, whether you do something or don't, it's not fight or flight. Remember, it's fight, flight, or nothing. So these people, when they talk about doing nothing through action, they're talking about just standing like deer in the headlights. Well, nobody ever thinks that that's the correct course.
Okay. Yeah. Remind me, because I don't remember, it's been a while. Remind me your position on Blink of an Eye.
Blink of an eye.
Yeah, that's where Voyager ends
episode.
Up. Yeah, it's in just by accident they ended up in orbit and completely altered that planet's society forever. I mean,
Do I think what?
Well, I mean, where do you? It was an accident.
Well, but I think that just highlights my point that James understands so well, that you can't be flying through the universe in a starship and think that you're not going to interfere with anything.
Right. So. Just by passing by, you accidentally interfered.
Yeah, accidentally. Well, you didn't accidentally go into space, so you purposely interfered. You just didn't know how you were going to interfere.
Right.
Well, whatever.
Right. It's a good episode, by the way. I actually give that one a 5.
It deserves it.
Yep. Okay, then. So, well, thank you. So that way, when you listen to, I believe it's Manhunt that it was on, that you don't go, what the hell? What's wrong with him? You didn't understand? No. Okay. All right. So let's go ahead and go into Samaritan Snare. And, Kieran McDuff, you made it to the first one this time. Excellent. Kieran says, I love the pack leads. Me too. To this day, me and my dad refer to pack leads when talking about stupid people. Which, when you look back on this episode, you have to wonder whether or not they were actually stupid. Yes, they talked in a manner that made them sound like they were stupid. But then, again, maybe the Universal Translator was struggling with their language and made them sound that way. And yes, they fell for the Crimson Force Field stunt. But then, Baylock fell for the Corbinite maneuver. And he seemed pretty smart. In fact, he seemed to speak quite deliberately, and he looked like a child. Maybe we've misjudged the Packlids after all this time. Ha 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 ha! That was my laugh, by the way. Was it a good Baylock at all?
It was a good attempt.
you drink Tranya! Anyway, there you go. After all, as Data pointed out, it's a wonder why they ever achieved warp travel, but surely that's exactly what must have happened at some point, otherwise they'd never encounter any other species. Or is that the whole problem? Was their first encounter with things that make us go a species that didn't respect the prime directive? Incidentally, that in-your-face look Geordi got when they said, we look for things that make us go is ridiculously obvious once you know the whole story. I can't believe I didn't see this the first time round. What's he mean? Because I think I was talking about the one guy kind of gave Geordi a...
What it was here is that when Geordi was on the other ship, on the Packlet ship, he mentions, you know, that they look for things that make them go, and they specifically look at Geordi, and I think they give an good indication that they are after him.
Okay. That's why he goes on to say it couldn't have been more obvious if they kidnapped Troy and he'd been standing there licking his lips and rubbing his thighs in anticipation. I don't know. what did I say if they sent Ensign Gomez aboard instead of Geordi? Do you remember that?
I have no recollection of that, but I have a bad memory.
I don't know if anybody remembers, but no, I said that if they had to send somebody like Geordi, because if they sent Ensign Gomez, they probably would have gang raped her right on the view screen.
Oh, and then we had this conversation about how much rape there is in this show, right?
Yeah.
No, I was quite upset by that. I don't think we have that much rape at all.
No,
I at least try to avoid it.
He tries, but anyway. He goes on to say, in fact, never mind Troy, this episode would have been way darker had Sonia Gomez been the engineer to go over there. Oh, boy. But then they'd have time to listen to Worf for that to happen. And even though he was entirely right in this instance, he was ignored anyway. If I were Worf, I'd probably have spent the rest of the month telling everybody they should have listened to him the next time. No, he wouldn't do that. Meanwhile, on the most awkward shuttlecraft trip ever. Okay, maybe not. I did not start this way, but actually it seemed to get better as they went. I don't know exactly how Wesley's trip fit into the overall story arc. It definitely seemed like they reckoned they'd find a way to get Wesley onto the shuttlecraft later and forgot about it. But I like the story of how Picard lost his real heart. Obviously, the story leads us to a fantastic episode, Tapestry, later. And that was a good way to have Wesley and Picard bond for a bit. But he's not his father. Oh no, that was deliberate. Definitely Jack. Oh, Brian Baker would be so sad. As for the replacement heart story in general, maybe the heart unit needs replaced every so often the same way the card parts need to be replaced because they wear out. Indeed, I'm pretty sure the fillings in my teeth need to be done after about 10 years for the same reason, so it's not like body parts don't do this already. Good point. I also agree with me about the ending. Of course, he's talking about me. I think if Picard doesn't have problems, then no one knows about the heart and he doesn't get applauded onto the bridge later. Actually, that was my favorite bit of the podcast. It was good to hear James come round to that thinking, too. See, discussions are useful. No one should ever question why we do these podcasts. Just a couple other points on the podcast itself. Did the feedback get lost in the editing? In fact, the captain's log gets lost as well. I was expecting some singing, and then we went, and then we just kind of moved on. I really like the captain's log. It's a great summation of the episode in a comedy style. Wow. Finally, it's almost a shame that it's St. Patrick's Day today, and as I listen to this, not next week, when I listen to Up the Long Ladder, if ever there was a day to complain about ridiculous Irish stereotypes, then it would be today. But I'll save my moans about that episode for next week. I didn't think of that. And, you know, it actually, the podcast came out a few days after St. Patrick's Day. Had I planned ahead, I actually would have released it a day before. And then when it hit the RSS feeds, it would have been done on St. Patrick's Day. Darn it, why didn't I
don't know why. I don't know why you'd want to make St. Patrick angry.
Yeah. Oh, he forgot to give it a rating. He says 4 out of 5 for him, making it down, marking it down for Worf stating the obvious and being shot down for it, only to be proven right all along. Okay, let me go back into a couple things. Yes, the feedback did get lost. We made up for it in like the 1 or 2 episodes after that. And the singing. You know why? I screwed up. I screwed up mid-song. It actually was there, James. You remember I sang the captain's log?
Oh, I remember.
Yeah. I'll be honest, I put the wrong name down for our guest because I actually put the guest name in, but I put the wrong name. And when I got to that line, I'm like, oh, wait, no, this doesn't work. And I was going to put it in later, just re-record it, and I completely forgot, along with the forum feedback. Just completely forgot. So maybe one of these days I will go back to that and record it and put it on for you. But I won't make James go through it twice. So James, I think you're going to get out of reading stuff because I'm going to let Ben read his own forum feedback.
Excellent.
Do you want to read it?
No.
All right. I am torn, guys, when Samaritan Snare comes up. As a child, I saw the Paklas as just another alien, as innocent kids might do, and was completely concerned with Wesley and Picard. As a teenager, I felt the same way about this episode as many do about Code of Honor. I mean, laughing at stupid people is okay. As a brother, I see reason and learn that when you must choose between saving only one and saving none, you must take the risk to save both men, so Picard will have to wait. As a dad, I think I'm becoming used to Wesley. I may even be liking him now. As an adult, however, I realize they are trying to flip the script on us. You see, Timmy, don't judge a book by its cover. Riker should have learned that very message. However, they failed to pull the trigger, failed to make the crew pay a cost for their arrogance. It is a missed opportunity indeed. So 5 stars. Hmm. Okay. I mean, how many times do you hear missed opportunity about like Star Trek Voyager or Enterprise? Mm. You know what I mean? It's always missed opportunity this, missed opportunity that. And I know this episode is enjoyed by many people. It's Samaritan Snare. But, you know, there's plenty of missed opportunities in it. It's not that good of an episode on any technical merits.
Okay. But still gets 5 stars.
Of course it gets 5 stars. It's Next Generation, man.
Okay. I'm going to remind you when we do our review, our final thoughts and rating.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
We may skip past you and assume it's 5 stars.
I do got to know, though, guys. I mean, is everybody else blind to the fact that they're making fun of retarded people in this episode?
No, I don't think they are.
I don't think they are here. I think they're really smart.
And I think that they are. I mean, I think that's what they're trying. They at least put out. People get caught off guard, right, when they come across and it sounds like they're not quite there. And I think the crew judge them and they judge them wrongly, and then I think, you know, later on they realize that they've misjudged these guys.
Really, you think that's the case, though, because they certainly defeated them in the most childish manner ever.
Oh, I don't think that the reverse psychology thing at the end, or the hey, I'm going to give you a cookie and then take away a cookie and then you're going to cry about your lost cookie. Yeah. I appreciate that's not the most grand plan you can come up with, but I think they're just trying to wrap the episode up quickly at the end rather than just assume that these guys are slow guys.
Which is why they missed the opportunity to show us these people as intelligent creatures who deserve to be where they are, deserve to be an adversary and an enemy. They failed to do that because they don't make the crew pay any costs for their overlooking these people, misjudging these people. You know? Star Trek's going to tell us a message, but if they're going to tell us a message, they better give us a reason to swallow it. And they don't, not in this episode. I mean, Kieran McDuff clearly said at the top, as people who have only seen this episode cursory, he laughs with his father when talking about stupid people. I know that. I sympathize because my dad and I, we make things go. I mean, that's what comes from it, you know? So whatever they intended to do, I don't think they succeeded. But it's still a great episode.
Okay. Well then, let's see. Are we done with that, Doc? I think we are.
No, we're done with the forum feedback. So, hey, as Kieran McDuff has kind of put the first marker into the yes column on do we like the captain's log, I hope that you have a captain's log ready, Lou.
Yeah, but I embarrass easy in front of ladies.
Okay. I go with Ben. You have nothing to be embarrassed about.
Yeah. It's like, oh, God. I can't think of the name of it, but it's like what when SpongeBob was infatuated with. Do you remember who that was? He kept saying his name.
So I want SpongeBob SquarePants. Yeah.
Are you talking about the superheroes he's obsessed with?
Yes, or no? Yeah. There was one that he. I can't think.
Captain Underpants. Or no, that's
is that Doug? That's Doug.
No, I think
what was that? I don't remember.
It's kind of like, you know, what we would for a rock star if we see them.
Right.
I can't think of his name, but that's what I think of when I think of Ben.
Yeah, it's the two superheroes.
Yeah.
The old men were superheroes.
Oh, Merman and...
Barnacle Boy.
Barnacle Boy, yes.
I think.
Too many superheroes in my head, I guess.
Two superheroes. That's Ben. Okay, well, like Captain's Log. Mm-hmm. It's going to be dumb again, but I still do them. This may be my ship, but that doesn't mean I'm really in charge. Starfleet has ordered me to take part in a highly dangerous and ill-conceived experiment, and I want it stopped immediately. Okay, admittedly, it's not that dangerous, and it does make sense, but still. The Enterprise is to take part in a war games exercise. I was looking forward to a cup of tea, Earl Grey, hot, but now I have to spend precious time entertaining a crackpot Zach Dorn who wants to play paintball on my ship. End of log.
I like it, Lou.
Yeah, that was good.
Oh, that was dumb. But I can't think of it. I try to come up with something funny, but I can never think of anything. Anyway, so we start out with the captain's log. He's got misgivings. Why do you guys think that is? I think this is something that should be done every day on the holodeck.
James, we defer to you.
Oh, you don't need to defer to me at all. I mean, we've already seen, right, that they have target practice and they have training, and this is a natural extension of that. And, I mean, I know that Picard's a little stuffy about it, and maybe he doesn't quite see the need for this, because maybe he just hasn't come across as many instances as Captain. But the way that Riker tries to shoot this whole thing down is silly in my mind. He clearly should benefit from this, and I don't see why they are so against it, other than that it allows them to have a bit of confrontation with the weird guy with the thingy on his cheek. That's how I've got him down as. I can't remember his name.
Kolrami.
Indeed.
Cirna Kolrami. Who's played by Roy Brocksmith. Do you guys know where else he's on Star Trek?
Nope.
But isn't there another one of these guys in like season 7? Is he one of those?
Could be, no. But I mean, Roy Brocksmith. Do you know where else he plays on Star Trek?
No.
Oh, I thought the voice would give it away. He was Rosica Karn on DS9. He was a Bajoran resistance fighter against the Cardassians. And he purchases a hull fragment from a Ferengi merchant on a ship called the Ravenok. That's the one where we eventually meet up with Tora Zial.
Oh.
So he meets Kira. Really? He meets Kira in the Badlands, and she's with Dukat, who happens to let him know he's got 12 outstanding warrants on Cardassia, but he's not taking him in today. So. And, of course, we also have Quark in this one, just not called Quark.
I asked Sarah, like, what, 3 times? Do you recognize that person? Do you recognize that person?
I thought it was a trick question. I did recognize him. I thought, okay, well, this must be a trick, because I think he looks like him, and he sounds like him. Mm-hmm. He doesn't look exactly like him, but you can tell by his features. That.
Oh, yeah. As soon as he said, "I am Brockdaw," I was like, "Oh yeah, that's Quark's voice. That is awesome." Okay, let me ask you this: do you think we could have done this without the derelict Hathaway? I mean, couldn't we have done this on the holodeck?
So that brings up my thought process on the question: why are they resisting this exercise? Because Starfleet is like an overpowered organization. They really value their shields. They value their defensive weapons. The idea that phasers can stun versus kill. I mean, in Deep Space Nine, they talk about they have 16 different settings on the phaser rifles, and a Cardassian has 4. This shows you that Starfleet likes to be overpowered. They like to have every avenue covered, so that when they go into a confrontation, they're not concerned. That's why they always let people shoot them a bunch of times before they fire back. Right?
That explains it.
So, in this situation, though, they're not testing Picard's ability to defend as an overpowered vessel. They're testing Riker's ability as an underpowered vessel to defeat an overpowered entity, which is not really the way Starfleet likes to operate. So I think that is what adds the military aspect to it, the whole resistance fighter aspect to it, that's what they're not liking. Because that means they've lost, right? So they're not going to entertain this idea that, we've gotten our butts kicked, so now we got to, fight tooth and nail with every last derelict ship we got, floating around the graveyards.
Right. And who saves the day in the end?
This episode?
Yeah.
Wesley.
Yeah, of course. All right. I got that out of the way. I don't have to talk about it later.
He doesn't really save the episode.
Sure he does.
I think people overplay how much Wesley saves the ship.
Sure he does.
We'll get there when we get there, James.
Yeah, we'll get there. We'll have to talk about that. If you don't think Wesley saved the ship, then we have to go there.
At most, he saved the Hathaway. He didn't save the Enterprise.
About the resisting?
That's a good point. Yeah, that's true.
So about the resisting, I didn't realize they were resisting the exercise. I thought they were resisting the person, Comrade, whatever, him leading the exercise, because all of them have a bad taste in their mouth about him. And so I wonder if had it been approached by someone else, maybe they would have been more open.
Well, because Riker says it's a waste of time to test their combat skills. It's a minor makeup of a starship captain. I think they were... Obviously, they had a lot of hostility toward Kolarami, but no, I think they were completely resistant to this whole entire thing. They just want to go on with their lives, but Starfleet's making them do this.
That's true, and Riker did say, maybe I'll want to come back home
before
we left, so...
Yeah, well, yeah. I would have too.
Yeah.
So, but again, you always train and prepare for the possibility that you need these skills. So why not do it anyway? It should have been all in fun.
Well, and they're definitely not a military organization. I mean, I think it was Picard who made that point. Starfleet's not a military organization. That's understandable because they're not.
Right.
They might have a militant aspect to them, but
Yeah, but he's pretty reasonable, and so I was thinking, that's why I think if it had been led by someone else, they would have been more open to it.
Maybe.
Not such a snide person.
Right. Yeah, they had a lot of hostility, and maybe, you know, he was somewhat arrogant, like you say, but maybe that's just a Zach Dorn trait, and why not accept them for who they are? Just kind of
right.
Go on with life and let them.
I like his character.
Oh, I thought he was awesome.
I love it. I love his nonverbal banter with people, his mannerisms, and the way he would look at people. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes you don't need words.
Okay. Doc, unless you have anything on that, I'm going to go on to what I call the WTF moment.
Well, by the way, I also like the, you know, I like the guy as well. What's his name? Cole Marmy, right?
Cole Rami.
Cole Rami.
Cole Rami. Cole Rami. I think he's a good guy, and I like him. And I know that he kind of rubs the crew slightly the wrong way, but, you know, if this had been a Klingon officer, right, and a Klingon came in and pushed his particular view of how you have to do war games, that character would probably also rub them up the wrong way, as would an overly Vulcan guy coming in. So to me, I think that I think Riker and Picard are being a little bit too sensitive on this.
Okay.
Yeah.
He is a third level grandmaster at the game of Stratagema. It's not a real game, but you'd think in all these years, what are we talking, 89, 15, 11, 15, 26 years now? Why didn't somebody actually develop that game?
But there's chess.
You should get on that.
Yeah, somebody's got to get on Stratagema.
Yeah, I think you've found your new project.
Oh, I wouldn't have the skills.
Since we're talking about Cole Rami, you know, Worf has that scene where they talk about reputation. I'm curious what you guys think. He says their you know, if nobody has tested the Zach Dorn, then their reputation means nothing.
Right.
What do you guys think about that? Is he correct?
I think he's wrong. And I actually think he's pretty wrong. Kind of like un-Klingon as well. I think we see elsewhere that Klingons are more than happy to accept kind of like reputation as being, you know, as being reasons to do or not do things. So I think this is a little out of character.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we'd have no backstory on them. We just have what they say about them. Now, had they gone on to say, like, well, yes, but they did defeat this race or someone, maybe somebody we know, they did give the Romulans a bloody nose or something, then there's something in his reputation, but we know nothing.
Well, when he says their reputation means nothing, but I was telling Ben, that's not true. Reputation is everything until someone challenges it and defeats them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and no matter your challenge is not what degrades the reputation, is defeating them. Actually, as a matter of fact, you bolster their reputation even further if you challenge and lose.
Yeah.
As you know.
Somebody finds out.
That's right.
Okay, so my WTF moment. Worf is all alone in his quarters, and he's building a model of a wooden sailing ship.
I had that same moment.
What? What the hell am I looking at? And he snaps a stick in half when the door chimes.
This is manly Klingon finger.
Am I interrupting something? So throws it all in a drawer. I was just finished. Oh, no, you weren't. You still got more to do.
You haven't even really started. You keep breaking them.
I think he should have lost his family honor in that moment. Just building a wooden sailing ship. What the hell is this? So that's my WTF moment.
Is this the first time we see his quarters?
I have that down as a comment. I think it is. I think it's the first time we do see it.
There's no windows in it, are there?
No, I don't think we see any, no. No. And I kind of had a bit of a flashback, or I suppose it would be flash forward in this instance, to like the scene we get on the House of Quark, where you have the entire High Council trying to follow, you know, finances. It kind of like reminds me when Worf is trying to do something that he's clearly unsuited to as he's building up the model.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he pulls a Gowron.
Yeah.
Enough of this.
Enter!
Well, But he's pouting and he's angry, but why isn't he in the holodeck with his, what are they, bat lifts?
Yeah.
You know, taking his anger out. Yeah, I had that same moment going, why is he taking his anger out on that stick?
Okay, so if this is the first time we've seen his quarters, then I gotta know what y'all think. What do you think about his chair, and what do you think about the statue?
I was gonna ask about that. The chair, I love. That is awesome.
What does it remind you of?
You guys are really observant. Not look at his chair.
I don't know. What it should, here, let me...
But I think the chair is just nuts. I can't see anyone has invented, certainly not a warrior race, right? They wouldn't have had a chair like that. The statue's cool, right? And that's the statue of Kalos and his brother, who I always forget the name of, Phaeton. And that seems perfectly in place. But the chair looks a bit like a... Am I crazy, or is it a bit where he's either shaven, or at least he's looking at his goatee in that chair later on in the season?
Actually, the statue makes me think of Rocky. If that's what you're asking. But the chair, I'm not exactly sure what I'm supposed to get out of that. So, I mean, what about the chair, Ben?
It just looks like a dude holding a bunch of balloons to me. It's very festive in my mind. Like, it reminds me of a day like at the park or the zoo, you know, where, or the movie Up, maybe.
Yes, sure.
Maybe in the movie Up where the guy has all the balloons, you know? That's just what it reminds me of.
Is that a chair or is that a...
It's a chair. So he has a footstool and everything.
Yeah, he'll sit in it at some point.
Yeah, he gets his shoes shined on that.
Yeah, gets his shoes shined. I can't exactly get where it's functional.
No, it's definitely a piece of art.
Yeah, and he's got a little chair in the corner by the door, too, as well. Or something there. So, anyway. But, yeah, the statue makes me think of Rocky. And he even has a plant in there somewhere. But, no, I don't see any windows at all.
No, there's no windows.
Huh. I wonder why not. Okay.
Maybe that's why he's so grumpy.
Yeah. Okay, so now we know how Worf feels about the simulation. Just a waste of time. Unless you're able to die or kill somebody, then why even play the game?
Do you like in this scene where Riker uses reverse psychology on Worf?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, is Worf that manipulable, however that word goes?
Well, you need guile, and only Worf has guile. Once in a guile, you have to.
We've got this point now where Riker's going around picking up, you know, the competent officers from the Enterprise. But what we've kind of, in my opinion, what we've seen throughout the show so far is that, you know, if you do have the ability to cherry pick 40 officers from the Enterprise, I think it's kind of a bit of an unfair fight because I don't think there's that much depth of talent that we've seen so far on the Enterprise. So by the time he's taken a senior crew, the people that they've got left they're not the greatest guys in Starfleet.
Perhaps not, but out of 40 people, 37 of them are useless.
I mean, even so, yeah.
They don't use them. Only one woman on the bridge who's, they're gonna fall for it. Well, I mean, that's what she was there for. Beyond that, you have Wesley and Geordi in engineering, cheating. So, what else is there?
Well, then, you know, then I'm curious, though. If you don't have all the overpowered nature of Starfleet, is guile all you have left? I mean, is there another attribute that you could use to your advantage in this situation?
I don't know. There's no way the Hathaway could possibly have not only won, but actually been in the fight longer than 10-15 seconds had they not cheated.
What would your definition of them winning be? I'm curious.
Getting away.
Getting away. Okay.
Greetings, Professor Vulcan.
Hi. Hello. Are you still playing a game?
Of course, I should reach DEFCON 1 and launch my missiles in 28 hours. Would you like to see some projected kill ratios?
69% of the housing destroyed. 72 million people dead. Is this a game or is it real?
What's the difference?
for a while.
Yesterday's aim was interrupted, although primary goal has not yet been achieved. Solution is near. Game time elapsed. 31 hours, 12 minutes, 50 seconds. Estimated time remaining. 52 hours, 17 minutes, 10 seconds.
What is the primary goal?
You should know, Professor. You programmed me.
Oh, come on. What is the primary goal?
To win the game.
I think I really like that we had this scene where Riker goes and collects his crew, mostly because, I mean, Riker and Worf got a great chemistry between each other as characters. I think we've seen that in the past. But, so this just adds to it, I guess you could say. They're both kind of warriors. It makes sense. But I get real hung up on that idea of guile, because to me that sounds like a Klingon PC word for sneaky.
Yeah.
Doesn't that? And I don't really know. I think I'm with James. I think Worf is a bit out of character throughout this episode.
Hmm. Also, Riker walking around collecting people for his crew kind of reminds me of when he was thinking about going on the Ares. You know, do you think I should do it or not? So, all right. So Riker challenges Cole Rami to a game of stratagema that nobody has developed yet. He knows he's going to lose by a long shot, but he's totally jazzed to even play him. Now, what do you think of Worf betting heavily in the ship's pool that Riker takes him past the sixth plateau?
I thought that was dumb.
Yeah.
I flash forwards to the fourth Shap from NB6-9.
Yes.
The fourth Shap. Is that the Calamarine?
It is,
yes.
God. Okay. Actually, I sort of kind of like that episode, except for the Calamarine. I can't believe that they actually filmed that. Anyway.
I think the only reason they wrote him saying that is so that he could say that he would be irritated.
Oh, he must have been irritated. What do you think they bet, though?
Holodeck time.
Well, we had the same question last week, Blue, when they were playing a poker, and then all we came up with was pride. So he's probably bet some pride against someone else's pride.
No way. No, pride's easily swallowed. They definitely bet something of importance, or else why bet? You know?
Yeah, right.
A gentleman's bet is only between two cowards.
That's good. All right.
Why do you think that Riker challenges him, though? I mean, I know what he says, you know, but why do you guys think that they do this in an episode?
I think exactly for the reason he said. It's just it's an honor just to play the guy. He's that good. I mean, why wouldn't you?
I personally, he's just trying to get a story that he can use as a chat-up line when he's going picking up gay ladies in bars later on in the season. I think they would be impressed.
And I honestly think that this is where the continuity between the A and B plots come into play. Because Riker already understands what Data will learn. So he's putting himself in a position that Data would never have been put in voluntarily, because he doesn't know it. He has never experienced that situation before. So I think in some way, Riker values losing.
Yeah, that makes sense. I don't know if he really cared about winning or losing. He just wanted to play the game.
Well, he wanted to perform at a high level, above expectations. There's no question about that. I mean, you can see that in his face at the end of this match.
He thought he would be better.
He did.
Yeah. Well, he only got to 23 moves, so which plateau do you think that is?
The first.
He got waxed in the first few seconds. But Data, on the other hand, I don't get how Data could possibly have lost.
Well, I don't think he... I mean, first things first, he doesn't even understand why they're competing, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it takes Troy and Pulaski, lest we forget, you know, the two most important characters in this episode. It takes the two of them to explain it to him.
But by the way, Ben, I assume you're trolling with the Troy and Pulaski remark. But actually, I think we've seen, maybe it's toward the end of season two, as maybe the scripts have been a bit lighter on the ground, and you know, they've not. I've started to notice Data regressing slightly, and I think that, you know, him questioning both in terms of, you know, why would you compete? I mean, I think that's season one, early season one Data that surely should have been out of the, you know, out of the writing room by now. And then even what he goes through later when he kind of, you know, is unable to beat him at the game. Again, I think it doesn't quite sit right in my mind. I don't think this is the time that the Data should be learning these lessons. And I think that they're treating Data in, you know, worse than they have done in this season so far.
In other words, what he's saying is he can't believe that Data would bend.
Oh yeah, that was last week when Data he would bend instead of folding at cards.
Okay.
I mean, Data knows the rules of the game. I would say Data probably knows everything about the game more than everybody at the table combined, but yet he's gonna bend instead of fold.
Well, I'll be honest with you. I could give you made-up reasons as to why he would say that. You know, maybe like he has a subroutine that's practicing synonyms this week, and to fold, to bend. You know, he just picked the wrong one this time. Or maybe he was trying to be clever.
He was being funny.
Well, either way, that's hardly the point of why they write that into the script. But that's not the same thing as what's going on here, though.
No.
What's going on here is why would Data? Why would he have ever learned about competition? I mean, why does anybody compete in the first place? And why would he understand the reasons for competition?
Yeah. Well, it's like the Whopper computer. The whole reason is to win the game.
But when has Data ever competed? I mean, do you think? Yeah, he didn't compete to get into Starfleet. Didn't compete to be better than the human crew. I mean,
well, he had to compete. I mean, we see Wesley in this testing phase.
Do you think Cole Rami was competing against Riker in Stratagemon? He was not. Riker a lesson.
Yes.
And Data hasn't learned this lesson yet. He doesn't know why you compete.
I mean, having said that, Data must have learned how to compete to a certain extent, because he's been promoted to lieutenant commander by now. He's been in Starfleet for a decade or, you know, maybe longer. The criticism that I have is that I don't think this should be as alien to him as it comes across. Now, from a kind of a writing perspective, of course, it's great to be able to take these concepts and effectively, you know, develop the Data character. But I just don't quite see it fit in comfortably in his timeline. You know, had Data been discovered in the pilot, right? If they had actually found him on a planet somewhere and they brought him onto the crew, then maybe. But he's supposed to be a lieutenant commander with, you know, a decade of experience.
Yeah, but decade of experience where? I mean, and furthermore, though, James, Data's how many years old? 15 years or something? He's been in Starfleet. So, you know, they brought him into Starfleet. He was born into Starfleet. Okay, so you go by year progressions. I mean, Data's what, 14 now? I mean, how old are your kids? Are not that old. I doubt they really understand why we compete. They may feel the emotion of it, the emotion of losing, like in a race, a foot race. They know what it is emotionally to be second and to be last, maybe, or first even. So they would understand the emotion of competition, but they wouldn't understand the logic of it, the purpose of it, the reason for it. And that's something, you know, Data can't feel the emotion, so he would have never picked up on those things. He's going to have a conversation about it to understand the logic of it, because it's an illogical maneuver to compete. Especially Riker. Riker has no logic in his endeavor to take on Cole Rami. There's no reason.
No, just for the fun of it.
There's no reason on the no logical reason. There's emotional value to it, but no logic, no logical value.
Okay. I guess that'd be like me trying to arm wrestle the world champion. The only thing I'm going to get is my arm torn off.
Well, maybe. So. But I also do want to say, James, I'm not trolling about Troy and Pulaski. I actually do feel that they're the most important characters in this episode.
Okay. Well, that's fine.
Actually, the thing about Data, I am actually with James on this. It didn't sit well with me either. And when there was a part where he was going, but I don't have this, but I don't have that. And I was like, God, just the flash of Pinocchio, like, I'm not a real boy, like, yeah. Popped into my head. It was so annoying to me.
All right, then. Let's see. What are we at? So Wrecker has 2 days to get the derelict Hathaway ready to destroy the Enterprise. The bridge is in shambles, full of cobwebs, wires hanging around, and everyone will lose a lot of sleep. But with everyone's skill and stamina, we can make this old lady fart. It's just about the only thing they're going to make this old lady do, because he ain't going anywhere. Did Hathaway look like any other ship that we've seen before?
No, never seen it before.
No, I'm being serious, because it's driving
me crazy. It's a Stargazer.
Is it the Stargazer? Okay. Yeah.
Come on, Lou.
No, I was serious. It was driving me crazy. I'm like, I know I've seen this ship before, but... Yes, okay. Stargazer.
And of course, the bridge itself is the Battle Bridge.
Right.
Although most bridges, you know, most alternative bridges are.
Just redressed a bit.
Yeah. Right.
But do you like the dressing, though, is the real question. I mean, it's... For all intents and purposes, a brand new ship we've never seen before, right? We didn't even really talk about it yet, but you know, now we get to see a quote brand new bridge, brand new displays, and whatnot. So brand new dressings, I guess. I don't know. That's kind of interesting. What do you think about the tactical officer sitting as just a little bit in front and to the right of the captain?
I mean, was that a specific tactical?
Yeah, it says position. Yeah,
because it, to me it seemed like, you know, Riker was effectively offering up the, you know, the first officer position to Worf, and you know, whilst he's there, I kind of felt from the story perspective it was convenient for him and Worf to be next to each other under these specific circumstances, and you know, I didn't think too much about it in terms of the design or the ship design perspective in the real world. I thought it was a construct of the storytelling for this specific case.
I thought it was just a first officer's chair. And you just... I don't see any tactical, though. But, I don't know. I just thought it was first officer, and he was also filling in as tactical as well.
But the design-wise, you guys... I mean, even if it is just the first officer...
That is interesting, you know, that the first officer has a workstation console, like, on the bridge of the Enterprise. Yeah. But, actually, I kind of liked the ship. It was kind of interesting to see all the wires, and they're just, you got people throwing wires all around, trying to get it ready.
And am I crazy that in just saying that it seems like a generic Starfleet ship or generic old Starfleet ship that they can like put together? I didn't see anything too unusual, too beyond, for example, the Stargazer, or too beyond the other ships, you know, certainly the science ships that they have encountered in the past.
Yeah.
Ben, over to you. What do you see as unique in this particular setup?
Well, I think that this is obviously supposed to be a militarized vessel, bridge, especially. I mean, that's why they put, and they must have changed it on the Blu-rays. They must have put the name tactical on the side on the Blu-rays, or they made it more clear to see, because you definitely can't see it on Netflix. However, the little signage is on the left-hand side of the console. Anyhow, that's irrelevant. What
really?
I really like, yeah.
I would like to see that. Okay, yeah.
There's like gotta be a close-up scene. I remember I was paused. Anyway, what I like about it the most is I always like when the captain see. Okay, like on Enterprise D, the captain's flanked by his like cohorts. His it's like the royal court, you know. So it shows a certain level of deference to his right and left hand man. You know, Riker's his right hand man, sits on the right hand side. Troy is his queen, so she sits on the left hand side. But they're all sitting in equal stature. In that, you know, basically in that sense, sure, focusing on the captain at the center. But I like this, though. I like the idea that the captain his only job is to facilitate, not to do any sort of action. So I like that he doesn't have a console at his station. I like that
they do those things. And they kind of do that in Enterprise D, but this one's very overt about the way the bridge is set up and the stations are set up. And I don't know, I kind of enjoy that action look.
Yeah, to me it actually looked like there was only just the captain who was in front, and then you have Worf a little off to the right and back. Whereas on the Enterprise D, it's almost like a horseshoe with the captain being behind, not behind, but a little further back from the first officer and the queen's chair.
Well, I just always like, because one of the most hated movies, Star Trek Generations, the Enterprise B's bridge. I love that bridge. I really do. I think it's just an incredible layout. If you go look at it, it's very circular. The captain's sitting right in the middle, the perfect place. And this kind of has a little bit more of that feel to it, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, am I crazy in thinking that there are echoes of the Voyager bridge as well in the B?
Well, the Voyager does definitely have all its stations set off to the sides and whatnot, but not to this extent, I don't think. Oh, you mean Enterprise B?
Yeah, Enterprise B.
There is a bit of that, although the levels in Voyager, for direction purposes, TV purposes, there's mm-hmm. higher levels in the back so you can see the characters better and stuff. Mm. Not quite the same. It's probably one of the reasons people don't like the B that much, because it's not, might be designed for function, but not for the screen.
Yeah.
No, I like the B a lot.
You guys pay attention to these bridges so much. Oh my god.
Well, this is only like the fifth time I've seen this episode.
I think, Sarah, I may have zoned out there.
That's all? Only five?
I stopped counting.
Wow.
Oh, I only got one hand, Lou.
Do not let him fool you.
I was going to say, I think I listened to this more times on a pizza route than I ever watched it, but, there's way more than five. And speaking of Voyager's Bridge, don't you think it was kind of like a little big with a lot of wasted space?
You mean Voyager?
Yeah.
Oh, whatever. That's the greatest tactical bridge ever created.
Oh, I love the bridge. I think
there's all sorts of firing points on that bridge. Like, I mean,
so many places for Janeway to lay down and do her pain face.
Yeah, so many places yes. for her pain face.
Exactly. Right. Right. It just seemed like a lot of dead space. You have to keep walking around railings to get everywhere. And it just didn't seem functional with all the railings upon railings.
No, but also, I mean, the Enterprise D bridge, right? That there's a vast amount of space which is empty.
Yeah, that's true. A
huge, huge empty space at the front. I mean, I'm surprised they didn't use it for, well, I don't know, a desk every now and again. Obviously, they put the side consoles in Generations. Extra cargo at the front.
Right.
A table to sit at.
Yeah. Well, they did make some alterations for yesterday's Enterprise, and I know what you mean. Okay, well, we gotta go on, man. Unbelievable. This is gonna be a long one. Doc's gonna probably bring that up soon.
Like with Ben.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Huh.
He likes to talk.
Okay, so Worf says he can use his command codes to trick the Enterprise. Don't you think they should have erased his command codes before he left the ship, or when he left the ship?
A perfect example of why Starfleet is overpowered. They overlook those little tiny flaws in their system.
Yeah, but that, what is his name?
Cole Rami.
Cole Rami should have thought of that.
Mm-hmm.
If he's such a master.
Yeah. Because he does show off his brilliance when Wesley wants to return the ship.
Oh, monitor that child. That schoolboy that he calls him. But now he doesn't trust him. Now he may have something up his sleeves.
Right. He was absolutely right. You know, he needs to be escorted, monitor what he's doing, and save his research. And I can't think of his name. I thought I had it here, too.
So who are you talking about here?
The escort.
This was Ensign Burke.
Yes, Ensign Burke.
Because he behaves, unfortunately, very much like a Burke. And I don't know if that's an English word that you don't get. But he was dreadful, right? He didn't do his job well. And, you know, when Wesley has taken literally 35 seconds to unplug an antimatter experiment, he's like, oh, how long is it going to be? I've got things to do.
Wasn't he going over to watch that game? to competition. So he reminded me of a teenager having to babysit his younger brother, and he's like, oh man, I just want to go hang out with my friends and watch this. Now I have to watch you. You suck. Hurry up.
Oh, maybe that's what he was. Maybe he was very enthusiastically waiting for the data match.
That's what I thought it was. I'm not sure if that's correct. But
I thought he just wanted to. I thought he was just going for something. I thought he was just being a bit of a Burke. Do you guys know that?
It's only correct in if it only matters if it's correct in your mind, Sarah.
Everything's correct in my mind.
No, we don't know the word Burke. I never heard that euphemism.
Oh, it's not a euphemism.
It's a stupid person.
Huh?
So what's that race that everyone was saying was stupid?
Oh,
it's a packlet. So, yeah, we need to replace Burke with Packlet. And yes, James, I did cheat. Okay. Could you always say you could hear the clicking in the background, so. Okay.
It's like you had a nervous twitch. Sorry.
Yeah. Stratagema. Here we go. Data, and he beats the hell out of Data. So we go with the B story plot. Data's profound loss of confidence. How does one just remove himself from bridge duty?
I was thinking that too. Did he have permission?
And Picard just walks on and goes, well, all right.
Where's Data?
It's like,
oh, he's gone. Okay.
It's like calling in sick for the answer. Oh, I'm not coming into work today. Self-confidence issues.
He's a first officer. Okay. You know, I got to call my boss when I'm going to call in. I don't just, you know, call in general and say, I'm not going to be in. You got to call the boss. And Picard just doesn't rush down and go, what's wrong with you? Or do you know why he's removing himself from bridge duty in an important time here?
So,
well, he allows his whatever he thinks it is, a mistake or something happening. He allows that to cloud his duties.
I gotta know though.
And distract him.
Sorry, babe. I gotta know. What do you guys think though? I mean, Pulaski's the one who gets him in this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she's the one who tells him, whispers in his ear, "Bust him up." Right? And Troy interprets that to Data as in taking the shortest route to victory. James, you can't tell me for a second that you believe that the shortest route to victory is the best route to victory.
No. Hey, why are you picking on me?
I'm sure that's how you feel, though. I'm sure you believe in the long game.
No, I actually, honestly, I don't think the... if you think about it in terms of tennis, right? When you bust someone up at tennis or in any kind of adversarial sport, yes, you can, you know, go as quickly as you possibly can to the end state. But often playing with your opponents, allowing them a bit of a window to get in and then slamming it shut is often, you know, much more interesting and much more spectacular and would probably fall under the busting them up category. In fact, if anything, I think that how he behaves later and the route he takes to solve the problem that he has stumbled across with this guy at the end of the episode is really busting him up.
Yeah, he does bust.
Was Pulaski correct or incorrect to put Data in this position, though?
Oh, she just wanted to tear down Kohlrami, that's all. She didn't care about who would have won or lost. She did care about Data winning. She just wants to bust him up, just like she says.
Yeah, she only cares about that guy losing.
Yes.
Because she feels smarted by him for some reason and wants him to be, as she says, taken down a notch because she doesn't like his behavior and his attitude and his smugness.
Well, he's the villain. You're supposed to defeat the villain.
Right, but she's sort of kind of like the accomplice villain.
She's not against
Data, yeah. If you want to talk about a villain in this, then she's going to be because she set Data up for this whole thing to gain for herself, not for Data.
Well, you think that she cares about her own self above Data. In this situation about Data?
Yes, she cares about how she feels towards that guy. She does not care who she puts in there as her pawn.
Well, there's no question she doesn't like arrogance.
She goes, she's looking around going, who can take this guy out? You, Data, go. Do my bidding.
Actually, take care of her reaction to his loss would probably seal your point on that.
Yeah. I can't believe you just lost.
Yeah. She was befuddled.
Yeah, it was as if she lost.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Her whole
very
point.
Selfish motive.
Yeah.
Selfishly motivated. Selfishly.
How dare you say that?
Yeah. Her whole point was to tear him down. That's all. It didn't matter who did it.
Exactly. She just wanted to tear him down, and she wasn't thinking rationally, and that's what happened.
Well, I don't think I would have either. I mean, I can't believe he... I still don't believe he lost. I mean, his...
And what's the problem with Data losing? He loses all the time at poker.
Yes, but we're also talking about his speed. I mean, his fingers should have been able to blaze through where nobody
they
could have
been
seen.
Smoking.
Yes. There's no way he should have that Kolarami could have possibly outbeat him on the finger action. Data should have been and they've done.
I mean, if it's a competition of finger action, then maybe. But if it's a game of chess, like we don't even know whether whether people take turns in order and so on. So it might not just be in 100% reflexes. Because yes, if it's a count of reflexes, if it's a count of computational speed, then sure. But I actually don't really buy that Data would be so perturbed by this. We've already seen him lose in the games of chance, and he accepts it. And frankly, you have to accept it because you can do the optimal thing, the right thing, for want of a better word, and not succeed. And whilst you face an opponent at any kind of game, there is going to be some randomness in it as to how they react. And in fact, the way he describes how he ultimately beat him, it's very clear that there's randomness, or there at least there's the other player input into this game. So whilst that is in play, he has to make assumptions about how this guy's going to behave, and those assumptions cannot be absolute, they can only be probabilistic, at which point it becomes a game of chance. So I have no reason to believe that Data wouldn't accept this as just being this guy's very, very good. I didn't quite read him correctly. Move on. I don't know why he has this emotional breakdown.
Well, you guys are really getting into this whole, like, you guys are really selling yourself that Data has emotions. And I can understand how there's an actor behind the makeup who can't help but to insinuate emotion. So that we, the audience, understand the flow of the episode, the flow of the plot and the story. But take yourself out of it. Look at it for what it is supposed to be, what we're told as well. Data does not have emotions. You can't put something in that is clearly against his character just because you want it to be there. I mean, no emotions, and Data is obviously a robot.
Okay,
or a toaster, or whatever.
But by the way, everything I said, though, about the way he reacts, okay, I might have thrown in there that he has an emotional breakdown, but let's just remove that and say he gets into a little bit of subroutine and assumes that he's broken because he believes he's made the right choice and has ended up losing. I don't think that there's any need for him to have emotions in this episode for him to behave as he is written. So I think the emotion thing is probably just tangential. So I can accept, for the purpose of this episode, he has no emotions at all. I still don't believe Data should be reacting in a way that he does.
Mm-mm. No. Like the computer second-guessing itself on every action.
I think it's just a setup so that he can, like he says, change how he goes about
dealing with his nemesis. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you guys like the game itself, though? The physical game? Because this is very important to me.
It does look interesting. It does look like something that I would... I mean, I don't exactly understand how it works. I know there's like three columns of things, and you're trying to build up one of the columns, and the other guy's trying to knock your column down while he builds his column, or something to that point.
Well, you're on your way to finishing your project.
Yeah. It's just knowing computer programming skills that I unfortunately don't have. Okay, so, all right, let's go on. Let's talk about Commander Riker and his joviality.
I thought that was a really strange choice of words.
My interviews reveal a man who just doesn't know what he's doing. He's just too happy. You know, yeah. I kind of think. And then what do we have? We have Riker pretending to be angry at Wesley. Wes, you cheated. And he has that stern look, but then he says, do you think you could do it? So, I get what he's saying.
Well, he's supposed to scold him for cheating, and now, okay, can we win?
Hey, yeah, this might be what we need. 2-second warp jump. Yeah, that'd be pretty interesting. So, hand-holding an android.
So, hang on, but am I the only person that doesn't think it's cheating?
No, I don't think it's cheating either.
You know, perhaps I've just got a very low moral compass here. But
no, I didn't think it was. I thought it was improvising.
I mean, we're talking about
Worf. Oh, it's completely cheating.
No, we're talking about Worf, right? He has the secret command codes of the other ship, and he thinks it's a good and, you know, perhaps even an honorable thing to use them. I have much bigger problems with that than with Wesley managing to smuggle off, you know, a little bit of antimatter. Right. We already know that Geordi's managed to pack a bag full of goodies in engineering, and I don't really see it as that much of an issue.
That's true. Yeah, you're right, but you're wrong. see, the thing is that Worf can also override the command codes on the Ferengi ship as well. That's tactical. That's fooling the enemy. But to actually go onto the enemy ship to get some of their equipment to then bring back and use against them, that doesn't happen. Isn't clearly, all, that's cheating.
Isn't it all fair? Yeah,
it happens in best of both worlds.
No?
There's still rules in war.
Why?
That's a good question. Why?
But they wouldn't allow it. I mean, yeah, you're right. Best of both worlds. They beam aboard after their shields are down, beam aboard and steal a drone. But that's still tactical. No, I don't know. I mean, the battle hadn't begun. Therefore,
in order to cheat, you have to violate the rules. And we were never told a set of rules. We just get, in the end, Cole Rami
implying
that the ship was made warp inactive or whatever, and that that's not fair that they made it warp capable. But we don't know if they had to sign some sort of agreement. You know, all contests are generally facilitated by a set of rules, you know, whether it's sports or whatever have you. But we don't get that. So it's like impossible to know it's cheating.
And also that, what's his name? I can't
think. Cole Rami.
Cole Rami. He is expecting Wesley to do it because it may be allowed. So he's saying, okay, watch him. Watch him like a hawk. Because this could happen. So I don't think it's cheating. I think that was something that he went, oh, this is a great idea. And they stuck us with a really crappy ship.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm going to go get my project.
A four nacelle ship, nonetheless.
So,
mostly extra antimatter.
Yeah, but still, I guess they did a Kirk on the Kobayashi Maru. They cheated. I'd still say they cheated because the ship was supposed to be as is, and the whole point is to see how the ship with the less capability can handle a ship with the greater capability. But they almost evenly matched them, and that wasn't the point.
Still less. They can only. Yeah. They may be able to jump to warp.
Right.
Still less.
Less capable.
It's capable.
Yeah. Less, much less capable. Okay. All right. So 32 minutes into the episode, and we actually can get into the battle after the hand holding of the android, because he had to, you know, inject some confidence in Data. And then Data figures out, you know, what kind of man Riker is going to be. Obviously, the man he is. That's what he's going to do. He does what he does best.
When it was Troy, right, that was asking Data, you know, what kind of man he is. And then Data came forward with Warrior. I thought there was a little disconnect there, and I was almost expecting Data to come back with Bearded when they asked him what type of man Riker was. Because I don't necessarily get Riker as a warrior. I don't know. Am I alone in that? Clearly, Worf is a warrior. I think Riker's not quite. I wouldn't describe him as that.
Tricky.
Mm-hmm. Warrior is incorrect, especially because they contradict themselves later by saying, by giving elements of character that would not make him warrior. But hand-holding, By, are you talking about Picard hand-holding
That's
what I said. Data?
Now I have to go
yes. Hand-hold yeah, I have to go hand-hold an android.
That was one of the greatest speeches Picard's given.
It was
to date. Yeah, it's like as good. It was as good as almost as good as Measure of a Man.
He just couldn't believe he was having to do it. I don't know about that, but he couldn't believe he had to go handhold an android. But he did. He, you know, he went down, kicked him in the seat of his pants, and that got him working. But yeah, I think Riker's more of a tricky kind of guy.
I like what Data ends up saying is that the weaker Riker's position, the stronger his posture.
Yeah.
Now, if you recall back to the incredible episode with the first episode with the Ferengi in it, episode title?
Last Outpost.
Thank you very much. There is the end scene where Riker has to fight the gatekeeper or the keymaster or whoever the guy is called.
Dungeon master.
The dungeon.
Yeah.
Now you're talking Ghostbusters.
But in there, he talks
portal.
About...
He has portal. To face portal. Thank
you. You got to face portal with that big axe. His posture in that moment was quite strong. Chin up, chest out, shoulders back, erect. No arms akimbo or anything. Stout. Incredibly strong posture because he knew his position was incredibly weak. He even expresses that to Portal later about sometimes you have to know when to fight and when not to fight. So maybe Riker is not a warrior per se like we would see in Worf, but you know Riker will fight on the holodeck in Worf's programs. Riker will engage in conflict. He's not afraid of those things. I would say more along the lines that he's aggressive. And I think that's probably the word they really meant to use, is aggressive. And generally, the more aggressive something is, when in a weak position, they will posture the hardest or the most stout. So I liked that. I thought that was apt.
No, I certainly agree that I think Riker is the Riker character is certainly comes through even from those early episodes. I think that you know when Riker's back is against the wall is when you're going to expect. You know, the most unexpected from him, and I think that's the route that they're taking him through this episode, and I think it's good.
Okay. All right, good. So let's go into the battle. First thing, Kuma maneuver.
Kuman? That's a math teaching program.
I thought it said Kuma maneuver.
Oh, how Kuma. Kuma. I don't know that one either.
Yeah, I don't know what the maneuver. Nobody knows what the maneuver is. It looked like the one icon just kind of like. Darts up to the second icon. That's Kuma maneuver. But actually, the first one goes to goes to Hathaway because the Enterprise thinks a Romulan ship is approaching and about to attack. So, point one, Hathaway. But don't worry, someone's going to get some circumvenant attitude thrown at it real soon. Prepare beams for photon mode.
Bye bye, Hathaway.
By the way, I mean one thing I quite like this, you know, how they engaged each other and the you know the tactical moves that they were displaying, and you know you even get the instance where Geordi says, "Oh, hey, they're using that maneuver. You know, why so obvious?" We often don't see this when they're encountering other aliens and having to fight other aliens. It's always a much more simple, evasive maneuvers. And that's it. And I quite like the fact that they added extra language and extra flourishes into the way that they approached the tactical situation. And I would have pretty liked that in other episodes that weren't concentrating around war games.
I agree, James, because I get like evasive action pattern delta fatigue big time by, you know, 7-season Deep Space Nine. I'm like, Delta, Alpha, Omega. I mean, they only got 3 evasive patterns. I mean, when's the enemy going to figure this out? So I agree. I like the extra language. I think extra language in words is very important. I also, the extra language I would also say this episode has is a lot of visual language. There's a lot of extra visuals throughout this entire episode to sink your teeth into if you like it, or your eyes, or whatever.
Okay.
What do you think, though, about them saying that was the Kuma maneuver's point, and then they go and reveal their best hand with warp overriding sensor codes.
Yeah, well, I mean, they might still have the, you know, the warp drive dash thing up their sleeves, but they do, you know, Riker does mention that, you know, Geordi says, "Hey, why are they using this such an obvious trick?" And it's, and well, you know, they're waiting for us to reveal our hand. So here we go.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, well, that's conventional.
Yes. Yes. He's teasing. He wants us to reveal our tactics on his terms. But then you're right. That's immediately what they do. Because obviously the Enterprise was just going to take him out real quick. So Riker had to change the conditions of the test.
Do you think that Picard wants to bust Riker up?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, in the end, Picard was having fun with this until, you know, the Romulan shows up, sort of.
Oh, I never necessarily got that, by the way. I didn't feel that Picard was particularly engaged in this, and I mean, maybe it's because we didn't have a lot of screen time with, you know, Picard going through maneuvers or even having his thoughts about how he treats this assessment. He was very much defending Riker to the overseer dude, and if Picard would have thrown the match, for want of a better word, I think that would have probably been in character of the episode so far. I didn't see that there was much investment from Picard's perspective.
I think he was actually more interested and excited to see how Riker was going to outsmart him, because he expects him to be very tricky and do a great job. And so he was excited to show off his skills to that guy.
So he wasn't trying to embarrass him.
He was trying to get Riker to show his strength to that man, to kind of, just like Dr. Pulaski, say, see,
yeah,
he is good. You're wrong. You know, he wants to show him off.
That makes sense, too, because Picard gets almost giddy after Riker fools them the first time. He's excited about
it. He was excited about it.
Yeah.
So yeah. I thought he more was excited to show off his first officer and what he can do, and just tell that guy where to stick it.
Mm. Yeah, I think he got into it. Yeah. Change that code, would you, Mr. Data? Or Mr. Data, change that code. And then all of a sudden, here comes a Ferengi ship. You changed that code, didn't you? Yes. Well, you silly old... Oh, no. You know, he was getting into it until, you know, the first shot hit the ship. So
I think that's probably, like, direction-wise, one of the coolest parts about the episode is, I mean, because we are tricked as well, just like Picard is as the audience. And when, I mean, it's for real, the lights go down, the bright lights go down, the red lights come up, it gets dark, you see the shake, you see them really taking a beating all of a sudden. I mean, that's an intention getter.
Yes.
I thought that was excellently done.
Okay, so who was right? Picard or Kolrami? Picard wants to stay and fight and protect the Hathaway, and Kolrami wants to leave. Acceptable tactical losses. Who's right?
I think it's Picard. Preference on where you stand.
No, in wartime, Kolrami's correct. Yeah. It's 4% losses. I mean, that's not that much.
You'd have to, if you remove emotion from it and your feelings, I would say Kolrami is right. I think he's correct. Because you all agree with Spock when he says the needs of the many, right? And so if you take away your emotion towards the characters and you just purely think about it logically and how you're going to save your crew, what your job is as a captain is not to save that little handful. It's to save all the rest that you can. Yes. And so I think Kolrami is correct, and he's basically saying what Spock does. We just may not like his character, and so we want to disagree with him.
He is the villain telling us the truth.
He is the villain telling us the truth, and we don't want to hear the truth.
Yeah. No, I happen to agree with Kolrami, too.
So the only thing I was going to defend there is that, okay, sometimes the needs of the few outweigh the needs of the many, as we learned in Star Trek 3. And that was from the captain, not from the second officer. So I put more faith in Kirk. From my perspective, I have never considered the Ferengi to be a serious threat.
Uh-uh.
And I think that in this episode, I don't buy them as a serious threat. So although on paper, if it was like a Romulans, if it was the Borg and there was an actual threat there, it would be a more powerful argument that you have to run. But with the Ferengi, I just never buy them. And that's why I'm very very happy to side with Picard on this.
So here comes that gray area that we're willing to create and rationalize when it comes to right and wrong, and when we want maybe the both, we want our situation heard and we want us to be correct, we start creating a gray area.
Mm. Okay.
And that's where gray.
And I think the quote is in Star Trek 4, "No, Spock, because they thought you, the needs of the one, you, Spock, were more important than the needs of the many." I thought it was Spock's mother who said that.
No, it was Kirk. Why would you do this Amanda for me?
I think Amanda repeats it. In Star Trek 4, I think that Kirk mentions it right at the end when Spock gets his brain, or at least Katra, transplanted. It's a Katra, right?
Katra. Why would you do this?
Who watches the end of that movie? I mean, don't we all turn it off after the Bird of Prey lands on Vulcan and just be like, "That was an awesome scene. Don't need the rest."
The final view of Spock, he's effectively being told something illogical, and he sits there and he's got this real perplexed face on, and I really like it.
Well, that's the true essence. You never turn it off. Sometimes you just walk away, though.
All right, then. Let's see. Here we go. So what do you think of the ending battle, the solution? That, I guess it's the same thing that Worf played it, the trick on the Enterprise. He played it on the Ferengi. "Leader, another Federation ship is coming." Do you think they just, like, fell for that a little too easy?
This is why you don't consider the Ferengi a great threat.
Right.
Yeah. Or any threat whatsoever.
Well, it's... they are very emotional species. They're acted emotionally, both physically and verbally. They're very flamboyant and reactionary. So I think, unlike the Romulans, where you always like, you know, what are the Romulans thinking? You know, like, they're always deft in their maneuvers, and they plans within plans within plans, and moves and counter moves. When somebody's very reactionary, you know, you may not be able to predict what they're going to do, but you know it straight away. Like, as soon as they choose, you know what's up.
Mm-hmm. And in many ways, right, the trick that gets them out of the way is, you know, it's as simple as the trick that what we mentioned earlier with the packlets. Yep. You know, they fall very quickly, and then it's then let's go away. And that's it. It's just... you know, there's no follow-up, there's no gray area. You're right in terms that once they make the decision to go home with the tail between their legs, they warp out of there within 5 seconds and don't look back. It's too one-dimensional in my mind.
But they don't... I guess, remember Ferengi with this crew ever going against this crew before. Do they have any reason not to believe it? Have they been tricked by them before?
Oh, you mean why the Ferengi would buy this instantly?
Yeah, but they don't want to fight multiple ships. They saw an opportunity, and when it became
acceptable risk,
yeah, or acceptable loss. Yeah. But then when they saw another ship coming, they're gonna get out of there really quick because they're crooks. You know, they're thieves. Oop, gotta go. You know, they're not even going to take the chance to investigate it further because they're in for a quick buck. They're in for a quick deal. And then when they see a challenger, they're going to go, "Oh, nope, let's go."
No, I agree with that. And I do think this is in their reaction is in character with how the Ferengi have been built up. I just think that because of that, you can often get out of situations with the Ferengi by just spooking them, and spooking them quite easily. And that's why I don't consider them to be a big threat that you should have effectively, you know, handed over the 40 on the Hathaway and ran away. Because if they had been Romulans, then you know they're going to push you very hard. And I think the way that Ferengis have been written is that you can get out of it pretty easily.
So, James, you've seen Star Wars, obviously. Would you consider the Sand People dangerous?
Actually, I think Sand People are very, you know, when they mention, certainly Obi-Wan Kenobi mentions that, you know, easily startled. To me, that's what I'm perhaps speaking of with the Ferengi. I think easily startled would be a good description.
Which would mean that they're sneaky, stealthy predators.
Mm,
which would kind of But they don't really show us that very well, I don't think. If that was the intention to have the Ferengi be like that, that was not shown well from the beginning.
All they did was have them sneak into this little scenario.
They show up
out of nowhere.
There's also previous episodes that have kind of like shown us. Plus, they've already defeated the Ferengi like 3 times by now. Or this is the 3rd time to defeat the Ferengi. I mean, the 3rd time they defeated the Borg. What was that?
So do you think they only chose the Ferengi because that ship was...
I think they chose the Ferengi.
Broken down?
And I think they chose the Ferengi because you don't want to have... We've seen the Romulans recently. You know, the Klingons can't be the bad guy. The Borg don't exist yet as a tangible threat. It's only a threat of ideas. I mean, how many other bad guys they got? Unless it's going to be an alien of the week, which we never respect.
And they probably need somebody easily... I guess, tricked and defeated.
Yeah, I guess if they're going along with the idea, the concept of what the race should be, that they're fitting them as a race correctly into the episode. I think the problem, though, is just that nobody has any respect for the Ferengi. I think that's the problem, is nobody has any respect for them. So if you don't respect them, it's hard to believe that our heroes, our good guys that we're fighting for, would have any respect for them either. So
how long did they give them to decide if they're going to give up their ship?
3 of your Earth hours, I don't know.
No, was it like 10 minutes?
I thought it was 10 of your Earth minutes.
Yeah, 10 of your Earth minutes. Yeah, like your Earth minutes. But for me though, the minute you hear "I am Raktor," I mean, I don't care if that's Armin Shinnerman or not. It does not matter who that dude is. But Lita, I mean, they just crack me up. They're hilarious on screen. I mean, they are the most character. They are a caricature of a caricature bad guy comic book villain. I mean, I'm not gonna be scared of the Ferengi. It's Starfleet, man. They're overpowered. They're top dog. This is the Enterprise D. Captain Picard and Riker split up, working together as a team. They're gonna win. That's not the point. The point is not how threatening the Ferengi are. The point is how much do I enjoy seeing them when they come on, and they always make me laugh, which means I always enjoy them.
One thing that one reason why I think that we do push the Ferengi, or at least the writers push the Ferengi in early TNG, and I'd probably say up until, you know, like the 4th season when they kind of go a bit quiet, is that I think despite everything, I think the production design of the Ferengi is pretty good. I think it's iconic in the sense that you know who you're looking at. It's not a generic kind of small change to a human kind of thing. And the actual design of the Marauder ship is excellent, and I've mentioned this in previous shows. It's a great model that they've got. It doesn't in any way make up for the shortfalls of where the writing took us. But I actually just think that the quality of the design is probably why we see these guys more than, you know, maybe we should.
Yeah, they've invested a lot of money into them. I mean, in the real world, they kind of have to use them, James. Yeah, you're right.
Right.
And then you see them coming up in things like, what is it, the price and in
Price,
Troy, and you know, they don't need to be there, but they've got a really good looking ship. They've got known aliens. If it's a slight caricature, you know, whatever, but it is something that you can check into, and it's better to have the Ferengi right than having an alien of the week in my mind.
Yeah,
as long as it fits.
Yeah. I agree, James. I think that's, in the end, what you have to take away from it. Is, would you rather have the Ferengi showing up every now and then, or would you rather just always have some random silliness?
Yeah, I see. Yeah, you're right. Okay, guys. Well, it's time to go on to the final scene. The rematch between Data and Kolrami. Another game of stratagema that actually goes 35,693 moves until Kolrami quits the game. Obviously, Data was going for a draw. So, did he bust him up?
Emotionally.
He wounded his pride.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'm surprised he doesn't just walk out an airlock.
Well, Kolrami realizes what he's doing, and that's why he leaves.
Yeah.
You've made a mockery of me, because you could have beat me, but instead you just drug out the slow death, you know? You just, basically what you're doing, so you're making a mockery of me. I see what you're doing. Screw you. I'm out of here, you know?
Oh, yeah. He waddles out the door.
So I think that, you know, Star Trek oftentimes quotes has the message, the morals and the meanings and whatnot. This is an interesting episode because there is no, this is what we've learned today, folks. I think what we've learned is pretty important and pretty powerful, though, because it's not, to me, I like to compete. I like competition. I understand it very well. I competed my whole life and continue to compete in all sorts of ways, shapes, and forms. It's energizing for me. I enjoy it. Maybe James, that's why I'm picking on you. You're a quality opponent, perhaps. But nobody's perfect. Data says, "Oh, I'm not, or Pulaski said earlier in the episode that, but you're infallible, Data." And he's obviously that's not true. Well, could Data ever be infallible? He's not perfect. He'll never be perfect. He will make mistakes.
So created by a man.
Yeah, he was created by a man. Exactly. Did a man program him? Yes, he did. So do men make mistakes all the time? You can be 99.999% perfect, but you're not perfect. So why are you ever given an episode 5 stars, right? Because there is no such thing as perfection. But I love the message of this episode, because what Data does is realize something that it takes many competitors. Some never figure it out. Some figure it out earlier than others. It just depends on your experiences, but I think in many ways, but also your maturity. Data changes the conditions of victory here. You might call it a draw, or and maybe a tie is a loss in many people's books, but not to Data, because Data's intention, his what he redefined victory as, is not making the screen all Data's colors in Stratagem, and he redefined it as making Kohlrami quit. That was his intention. I know I'm a machine. I don't need to eat. I don't need to pee. I don't need to sleep. I don't suffer these things. What is my greatest strength and what is his greatest weakness? And how can I create a condition for victory in there? And that's exactly what he did. He changed his mind of what is winning and what is losing.
Well, and also if Kohlrami loses to an android, he can just say, well, he's an android.
Yeah.
But if he quits, he lost to himself.
That's right. Dang. So remember what Dukat said. It's not whether or not you beat your opponent in the end. It's not whether you win the war. It's true victory is making your opponent realize he was wrong to oppose me in the first place. That is busting somebody up.
Yeah.
Okay. That is what Data does. And I love it. The ability for him to if we can change. So, you know, there are so many obstacles and challenges we get put in front of us every day. You know, there's financial considerations, racial considerations, other social considerations, my own personal problems in life that I've gone through growing up, and these things, that, and the other, the way people treated me, the way people talked to me, the way I look, the way I think about myself. You have a million challenges that you will face every single day, and many of them you'll never overcome because they are inherent to you. You are an extroverted person who just can't shut their mouth and always talk too much, or you're an introverted person who never shares their ideas about life, and therefore they keep them to themselves. But these are all challenges we face. How do we fix our problems? We don't fix them by becoming, quote, better people. We are who we are, you know? By nature or by nurture, we are what we are. How we change is we change our perspective, we change our mindset, we change our idea of what winning is. And that is, it is understated. It is, as a matter of fact, it isn't even stated in the episode, but that is exactly what they show us. And that's what Riker does to Kohlrami. That's what Picard is trying to explain to Kohlrami. The episode is great plot continuity throughout the entire thing. The message of this episode is top notch.
Okay. All right, then. unless anybody has any more about the episode, I think we should go on to our...
Wait, Lou. You didn't tell us what you thought about Pulaski.
What about her?
Do you think that she was in... You have said throughout this entire season, we're coming to the end of season 2. This is the last episode of season 2, okay? I don't care about the next one. It doesn't count. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? It doesn't.
I'm kidding.
Have you come to some closure with Pulaski yet? Do you now see her as a useful person on this ship, a useful character, a valuable character?
In the end, yeah, I kind of started to I mean, there was a couple episodes that I thought she was pretty useful in. I think they wanted to make her the female Bones, and they did it the wrong way. That's what I think her flaw was. But in the end, they started writing her as a more likable person, yeah.
Do you think she was nice to date in this episode?
She felt bad for him.
Out of guilt.
Yeah, she was guilty. I mean, she felt guilty about what she did to him, but she used him as a tool to try and knock down another person.
Do you think her decisions, her choices made Data a better person in the end?
Yeah, actually. Yeah, it makes perfect sense. Once in a while you lose, then you pick back up and you go on.
Yeah, but that wasn't her doing. That was by accident.
No, but she was the one who said it to him.
She may have been a catalyst, but she, not on purpose.
That's irrelevant.
No, not on purpose, but still, it happened. And had it been in a more deadly situation, that's not the time we want Data to realize that he has to overcome his fear, I guess you could say. So, yeah, she did pretty good here. But is she... I don't know.
It's okay, you can say you like her.
Oh, I do kind of like... In the end, I kind of liked her. Compare her with Dr. Crusher. There are some future Dr. Crusher episodes that I would really do without. I kind of wish they would have just brought on a whole new doctor and tried again. But the audience liked Gates, and that's why she was back.
So I have a theory on this. When I was younger, I could not stand Dr. Crusher. I thought she was so emotional and whiny and always butting in and just making wrong decisions and, you know, and it was always revolving around her son.
Yeah.
And, you know, she was, and I would get so annoyed with her. And then as a mother and older, I started understanding a little more. She's still annoying and she still makes bad decisions, but I understand her a little more now, and so I would say that maybe women liked her more, women who are a little more feminine than myself or a little more emotional than myself would really like her, especially if they have, you know, when they have children, they go, oh, yeah, that's right, you know, you go, take care of your son and put him first. I still get annoyed with her. I don't really like whiny characters, but...
But you're right, class is better.
I understand more. Yeah, I would much, yes. I like her a lot more than Crusher.
Yes.
I kind of wish he would have went with another doctor, tried something else before they brought her back. But again, like I said, I believe it was the fans wanted Gates McFadden back, not Diana Muldaur. So that's how that went, I think, went down.
So. Right.
Gates is younger and prettier, there's no question.
Yeah.
That's a story.
Yeah, right. Okay, let's see here. It's now
Who's
time.
Who's your favorite doctor?
That's not this. It's not time for that,
Why?
Sarah.
Why?
Because Lou was about to tell you what time it's for.
Okay.
Phlox, by the way.
Okay.
That's ridiculous. That's
I don't. He's not my favorite doctor, but I like him.
Love Phlox. Love Phlox all the way around.
Okay, I've never understood how Phlox gets so much. Praise, to be honest. I just don't get it. I mean, the best doctor by far is the doctor from Voyager.
Yes, and that's my favorite doctor.
He's funnier. Doctor. He certainly is funnier, yeah.
And I have to admit, I'm a big fan of pretty much all of the doctors. I like McCoy, I like Bashir, I like Crusher, I like the EMH. I'm not too hot on Phlox. But yeah.
Bashir, I like him with others. Like, I like him as a supporting actor. Like, his relationships with... What's his name?
Yeah, his character pairings with
Brian. Yeah, his character pairings. That's what I like. Him, individually,
But Ben and I have had a discussion about Bashir, and I think he came around to my view that Bashir was great.
Really? Because I remember at the end of that episode, you went, oh man, you busted me up.
Bashir.
It wasn't a short route to victory.
It was not. I took the long way around. Trust me, it took forever to get there too, and still I'm laying in wait because Cena never published it.
Never published it because someone managed to get into Cena's house and, you know,
put a bat into her computer.
And I think Arizona's a lot closer than London.
I don't have a clue what you guys are talking about. I haven't heard anything like that. But well,
you are a physicist, Dr. James Roberts. I imagine that you created a magnet, because I know for a fact that you are a secret evil scientist that has a bot downstairs lair. And I know you have transporters and you warped your way over. It's no question.
I would so love to have a downstairs lair.
Yeah. And it's flat.
In my mind, you will always be Dr. Doofenshmirtz. From Phineas and Ferb.
Oh, God.
He's the greatest, though. Okay. Yeah, I know. Right. He's the best.
Okay, Doctor, what's
still, Dr. Phlox cured himself of being assimilated by the Borg, so anyway.
But that's more of a, you know, we've now written the Borg so poorly that we can do anything. I mean, that's like beating the Borg by willpower. I mean, by that point, it had fallen off a cliff, right? In terms of any threat the Borg had.
Yeah, that's true.
And by the way, the first contact has a lot to answer for that direction. Yes. They're the first that push it in that direction.
Right, they are. They made the Queen. The Queen is the end of the Borg.
It's now time to give a rating for this episode on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being the worst and 5 being the best. By the way, do we really need with 1 being the worst and 5 being the best? We're not really... We don't think much of our audience, do we?
No, I think it's very ethnocentric to not explain what 1 is the worst and 5 is the best. Because I'm pretty sure in Vietnam, the soldiers used to be called American GI number 10, number 10. That was not a compliment. Right, or at least I remember that from Full Metal Jacket, I think.
I don't remember that. I don't remember that. But they do it on the Delta Quadrant.
That's true.
Actually, I kind of like the way the Gamma Quadrant was doing it for a while there, with 1 being the Pakleds and 5 being, you know.
It's so subjective, though.
Yeah, it is. It is. And then when they come up with the 2, 3, or 4, they had to come up with something in between the 2, the 3 or whatever, the 5. So anyway, go ahead, Doc.
Oh, okay. So if you want me to give my overview on this episode first, I am going to land this episode as a 4 out of 5. I enjoyed it a lot. I think that there are lessons that we can take away from it. I do think that it's not a perfect episode, and I think it's a little bit clunky with Data, and I don't think he's particularly well written at the beginning in terms of there's too many season 1 inquiry stuff that goes on. But I enjoyed the war games. I enjoyed seeing Riker putting together his crew, going over to the Hathaway. It's very adventurous. It's good to see him getting up to that challenge. I quite liked the guest star that came in and rubbed everyone up the wrong way. That was fun, and lots of mild humor. I put it more strongly than that. I think that the resolve at the end, or the threat that brings itself in at the end, was quite clever in order to up the stakes, and it moves it away from being an episode where we can't lose anything other than our pride, perhaps, to an episode where that actually introduces a threat. And I thought they did that in a clever way. I think it's a little poor that you can get rid of the Ferengi by going boo very loudly, but that's you have to give that up because you've only got by that point 6 minutes to introduce them and to get them off screen. So it is in keeping with how we viewed Ferengi, and I don't think we've seen Ferengi this season, if I'm not mistaken. So it's good to have them back. I think the interaction with Pulaski is something I didn't mention. I think the interaction with Pulaski and Data was good. I don't think there was any android abuse this year, this week. And I think that Pulaski in general has become a much stronger character as the season's developed. And I see the relationship here with Data to be pretty natural. And I'm not going to moan at Pulaski at all on this. So yeah, I'm landing at a 4. Very enjoyable. We're going out of season 2 on a high note.
Okay.
Shall I hand over to our guests, too?
Well, since Ben gives it a 5, we can just go on to Sarah.
All right.
I don't want to rate it.
Why not?
Okay, well, I will give it a 3, just because it was not the most lively episode. I did like parts of it. There were some parts I didn't really like and didn't enjoy, and possibly irritated me. So I'm going to have to give it a 3.
But tell them what your favorite genre is. Of movies, television, whatever.
Action.
Action.
So there wasn't a lot of action. And the action that they did have was sort of mellow in my mind. And you know, so when you see action in Star Trek, sometimes it's like, oh, and they're all shaking around and getting crazy. And there wasn't really a lot of that. So I liked how they played it intelligently, but the action part of it wasn't quite to my taste.
Okay. All right, Ben, well, let's hear from you anyway.
All right, from me anyway. I think that this episode, I think the greatest strength of this episode, I said it earlier, but it is the visual language that we get to ingest this entire episode. We see a new ship. It has how do I really say it? Because nothing is quite unique except for Stratagemon. But I think that's enough, actually. I don't think you need any more than that game just being played. If it could have, I mean, the story gathers more depth because Data and Kohlrami have conflict over it. But just seeing that game with Riker in there would have been enough for me to have just wanted to see this episode over and over again. I mean, you add in the fact that they do have two models. They have the Hathaway flying over the top of the Enterprise, shooting lasers at it. That's pretty cool. The Ferengi on the view screen coming in, guns blazing, is awesome. I disagree with my wife. I think the action is pretty good.
No, it's just, it's not that. It's just for how slow, for me, because I get bored easily, sure. For how slow I felt like the episode was, I don't mind that as long as the action can come in and really just take me and go, oh, wow, and save it for me. Yeah. And for this one, it was a little mild, and not that it's ever really great. But
I would say, though, that what puts this episode above just a fun romp, an adventure, so to speak, is the fact that you have to really look for what this episode would bring to you, what it would bring to the characters. You have to really investigate into it, at least in my personal opinion. But bottom line is, I would watch this episode 100 times just to see, and would always watch this when it comes up on the television, you know, as a younger person, because I'd be like, that's the episode that has those things, that game that you play in your fingers. It's like Battleship. I love it. I want to play it. To see that, I would give it 5 stars.
I'm stunned. I did not think you'd pull out a 5.
Well, I used reverse psychology in the beginning, right? Something we didn't talk about, by the way. Not only does Riker convince Worf through reverse psychology, they basically, Troy basically tries to convince Data through reverse psychology. I don't know. It's okay. Just funny. I think reverse psychology was a big thing in the late 80s.
Okay. Well, then, I'm shocked. Anyway, that's fine. All right. Well, then, mine is going to be a lot more brief because it's creeping up to midnight. Or is it, James, about midnight for you?
11:30.
Okay. It's only 11:30 that would make it 5.5. This, for me, this really wasn't, it doesn't seem like much of an episode, but actually I do like it. I like the actor who plays Kohlrami, and I think his character is very funny. Just the sounds he makes. Yeah. His eyes pretty much tell everything about what he's thinking. I love this War Games aspect of the story. I'm perplexed why this isn't an everyday occurrence for the crew on the holodeck of why they ain't doing War Games. I'm sure they do, and maybe that's why this is a waste of time. We do this already, but they don't come across as such. Data's profound loss of confidence was brief, thank goodness. It just kind of made the story stop. I'm not sure where the writers were going with this. Was it just to be serious, or were they trying to be funny with Data losing his confidence and you have to handhold the android? Was it supposed to be funny, or were we supposed to feel bad for Data? The battle with the Ferengi, that was okay, but it wasn't long enough. We actually got 32 minutes into the episode before we even had the simulated battle, and then about 2 minutes later we had the real battle with the Ferengi. They're pretty much, Ferengi are like a bully on the playground trying to take your lunch money until they see your big brother coming along to defend you. Only this, in this case, the big brother was the illusion. Overall, I do think it's a good episode. I can't say it's a 5. It's not going to be on my desert island, but it's not going to be shipwrecked either. So in the end, I'm going to give Peak Performance a 4. I do love the concept about it. So,
I'm disappointed in all of you guys, especially Sarah for being the lowest rater.
Hey, you know me well enough to know that I would rate that low.
Yes.
And it's not, like I said, I like it. It's fine.
You don't have to explain yourself.
Oh, no. I will later.
Oh, yeah. You guys can finish this one later.
Yeah.
So.
Well.
Don't worry, you'll lose.
No.
I doubt it. Okay, so Sarah, I'm going to remind you again. You have 6 more episodes, unless they have all 6 taken by somebody and they're not going to let you on. 6 more episodes to get on that show. I still can't get my wife on this one. No, or on the Lou Truck show. She's just not interested in coming on. And I said, you know, I'll do a whole Voyager episode review or commentary, and you just come on with me. And she won't do it.
Well, you know, Ben's been trying to get me to play video games for 10 years now, so...
Still won't do it.
Still won't do it. Now he has my son, our son ganging
Your
up.
Son?
Yeah, my son. I raised him.
Okay. Anyway, Doc, let's go ahead and get out of this one. Yeah. Quickly.
Do you need me to say anything?
Well, it's the end.
I thought I did that last time.
I did.
Okay.
Next time on Star Trek The Next Generation. Commander Riker is invaded by an alien parasite.
My whole leg just went dead.
Their growth rate has doubled.
It's attacking his brain and nothing can stop it.
Respiration is erratic, pulse grossly irregular, blood pressure almost nil.
Can anything save him from a tragic death?
Hang on, Will. Hang on.
Find out next time on Star Trek The Next Generation.
Join us again next week as we review Season 3, Episode 1. Evolution?
I wish.
Or are we reviewing Season 2, Episode 22, Shades of Grey? I suppose tune in to find out.
Shades of 1.
Okay, well, I think we should thank our guests, both Sarah and Ben. So thank you, Ben, and thank you, Sarah, for popping by. Hope to have you back again soon.
Thank you for having us.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So, I'm James from London.
I'm Ben from Arizona.
I'm Sarah from Arizona.
You're not from Arizona.
Sure.
We're from Arizona.
We're all from Arizona. I used to be from Nebraska. That's what I'm going to sign off from now on.
I think we already... we did discuss this. We had even had a discussion about Dodge Street and its middle lane, didn't we?
Yes. Yes, we did.
I still occasionally see a head-on collision on Dodge Street because of that stupid middle lane. Anyway, that's a different story. I'm Lou from Nebraska, as he's pointed out. Take care and good night, guys.
Bye.
Bye.